Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. You know, we're recording this while we're all under work at home or stay at home orders, or I don't know. I think that's not the term that California is calling it. It's not quarantine. I don't remember what they call it. But anyway, it's, you know. One of the things we noticed, and Diane picked up on this, and we're recording this early in April, when she was putting together the webinar email that we send out, that she scours, I don't know, like 30 or so different sources for webinars and lists them for the upcoming month and then sends out an email. And it goes onto the website too. We would typically have 30 or so, 25, 30 events for a month that are reliability related in one form or another. And there's some asset management stuff in there, and there's some statistics stuff in there, and a range of topics. But it's been fairly steady over the last couple of years, 25, 30 events. Well, she found 49 events. One of them was one of one series of events that we listed only in one spot, but they had 9 different sessions, different topics. So 49 different webinars that made it through our filter to say, yeah, that makes sense to put on the list. So, you know, a significant increase. And then we published it. We try to get it out before the first of the month. And within the next 2-3 days, we ended up with, you know, here's another 15 to 20 of them from people that are converting courses to online, to people that are saying, hey, we can't go do, you know, lunch, you know, meet people at a local place and have a discussion, so we're going to do webinars, to others that are expanding their webinar series. They used to do one a month, now they're doing one a week. And so I'm suspecting that a lot of people, and engineers in particular, can work at home, right? And I'm seeing a change just on how people are reaching out to and communicating to the engineering community, increase in webinars just being one sample of that. And then in the news, Zoom is just all over the place. Apparently, it's so easy to use that it just basically, you know, went up 10x and it's or 20x in its usage in a month. And so I wish I would have bought some of that stock some time ago.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, but yeah. I suspect WebEx and GoToMeeting and all of these organizations that are doing these online meetings and webinars and events and training and stuff are also seeing a like increase on it. Yet you and I both know that sitting on a computer screen meeting for a couple of hours, much less 6 or 8 hours, which I've talked to a couple of engineers that they're just booked all day in one meeting after another with suppliers, with their boss, with their coworkers, with their team. You know, they're just on the phone or on a meeting all the time. And some of those are just absolutely horrendous, I know from experience, and others are actually very, very productive. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. We're ramping up during this unusual period of time where so much is being done from home, and some of that will relax and it'll moderate. But I have noticed some of them are grueling, arduous, and some of them go quite well. This is a great time for us to look at what works, what doesn't work, all of us, not just you and I, Fred, but I mean listeners as well, and try to guide what can we do in the future better to make online meetings work better, to make online training work better. I remember years back when I would teach FMEA, people would ask me, can you do an FMEA online? And I would say, well, I prefer, this is 15 years ago or whatever, when I would prefer to do the first meeting together, at least. If you have to do it online, get to know each other, get to, you know, so that you can know how people talk or react, or just kind of get some degree of bonding of the team. And then it's easier to work remotely. Mm-hmm. Because I learned years ago that a lot of communication is body language. I remember from Peter Block classes we took on consulting that if you can see someone in person, you can tell from their body language what they're saying better than if it's in writing or just audio. Mm-hmm. And so those nuances of body language are very important, and you get to know people. If you have good video cameras, then you can capture some of that. If you don't, you can't. But if you know people, you can kind of pick up when they're confused about something a little easier if you don't know them.
Right.
So there's technology is a big part of it. Knowing people in person beforehand is a big part of it. And then there's other enablers that we should talk about that would make things work better.
Well, I think there's some, just good housekeeping practices. I think there's pieces of that. And it's the same goes for just running a good meeting in general. I think there's a bunch of known rules and have an agenda, have an objective, things like that. I think there's also, I agree with what you said, is if you know the team, if you know the people and you've got an experience with them, you can do great things. Yet I've also had the experience of working with teams I've never met. Right. I get a call and they set up a contract and I'm on the phone or through email for a couple of months, essentially working mm-hmm. through an issue with them, usually a reliability plan or a test plan or something like that. And every now and then they'll send me some photos of, particular things they got questions of, or we'll get on a video call, but I've never met them in person. And it's different, yet it's possible. And I think if both sides come into it knowing that you don't have that, the nuance of body language. So if you're, for example, one of the things I think that makes it work, whether it's live or online, is that if you don't understand something, or if it just doesn't make sense, you don't attack the person, you ask a clarifying question. I don't quite understand this. What's the logic here, or how does this work? Add value to the meeting, add value to the understanding of yourself and the entire group. And if you take that stance online, you have to be a bit more aggressive of saying, hey, this doesn't make sense, or here's another way to look at this, or phrases like that allow you to contribute to the conversation, even though nobody knows that you're looking confused, because they don't, right? If we're just on a teleconference or on a web meeting that half the team doesn't have cameras on, you have to tell people when you're confused, for example, right? And I think the same kind of rules apply in live meetings. It's just, it's easier if when you're facilitating a meeting and somebody's looking furrowed-browed and crossed arms and, you can say, Sarah, is something not right? Are you not getting, something, you have a question or is something uncertainty? When you don't have that, then Sarah has to say something.
Well, yeah. And this is the body of knowledge or the skill that you're talking about is leading meetings and or facilitating meetings. And that is a really essential skill. It's not the same as an engineering skill. Mm-hmm. So you could be a great widget engineer. It doesn't mean you can lead a meeting remotely subject of widgets.
You can't lead a meeting if everybody's in the same paper bag.
Yes. Yeah. And so let me draw on, because I teach facilitation as one of the courses that I teach. And there's a couple things that are really important that you're talking about, Fred, and I just want to build on them. One is introverts and extroverts. Everybody has some personality style. Some people tend to be more introverted. Some people tend to be more extroverted. And what I always teach is that the extroverts are not better than the introverts. They just talk more. Mm-hmm. And the introverts think more. Introverts tend to think before they talk. Extroverts tend to talk first and think while they're talking. Mm-hmm. And if a meeting leader doesn't take that into account, the extroverts will dominate. And this is especially true online, because if you're in person, at least you can see this, you can see visually that a person is not talking. You just see it more easily. But if they're online, you might not notice that.
Right.
You might just hear the people that are talking, and then you react to those people. So you have to pay particular attention to get balanced input from all the attendees. And that's really where I'm going, is that's one of the skills of team leadership, is balanced input.
Well, you don't have to be the facilitator. I think it's a skill that a good facilitator will have the roster, or have photos of all the people that are participating, or have them on their screen or whatever, and go, you know, hey, George, I haven't heard from you. What do you think about this? And make space for them. And then not let the extrovert jump right in and go, I know what George's going, no, wait, hold on. Let George give him, you know, let him do his thing. It goes both ways, though, because somebody in the group could also say, you know, we haven't heard from Jesus lately. You know, Jesus, what do you think about this? Or the participants can hand off to each other.
Absolutely right.
Right. And I think it's not only the facilitator's burden to do that, but I think the facilitator can create an environment where that is encouraged and where the team looks out for each other and wants to hear from everybody, for example, especially when you're problem solving or brainstorming or doing things like that. That's the turning point for me, is when the team starts to call on each other to pull out the knowledge we suspect they have. Then you've got a good functioning team, you know, in a meeting.
Yeah, no, you're right. This can be very much a bottom-up approach. A good team can help each other. You don't have to wait for the team leader, so I completely agree on that. So some of those skills are very important, and everybody on the team can have those skills. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're saying. There's also some points about teaching.
Yep.
And this is in other words, running meetings is important, but also we can teach online, or we can have presentations or convey knowledge online, things like that. So I thought it'd be fun to look at what are some of the enablers to make for a good teaching environment or a good learning environment online as opposed to in person. I resisted it for years. I always thought I would teach in person for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And then a number of companies have approached me because of clearly leveraging their technology, because we have better online services, as well as reducing costs for travel and things like that. It's beneficial if you can do a good job of it. So I've had to do some thinking, and I've explored this a bit and as to how to do that. And a couple things I'll mention that I'd be interested in your thoughts is it's really important to have good, reasonably good equipment. In other words, you want to have good sound. You want people to be able to hear you. You want your visuals to show up clearly. If you're going to be photographed, in other words, if you're going to be videoed, mm-hmm. You have to have decent lighting.
Yep.
But then, in terms of teaching, I think it's important to realize that we need lots of involvement. I do this in person, but I even enhance it when I'm talking about teaching online, is to get feedback from people all the time as to how they're doing. If you're going to do quizzes, use branching, to where somebody might get the right answer, that's fine. But if they get the wrong answer, then you branch off into another area so that they can explore what they missed.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple of thoughts there. What are some of your thoughts of what works when you teach remotely?
Part of it is whether teaching live or doing a presentation live or doing a webinar or recording a lesson. I think the best way this is based on, like you, has been a student of this for years, but also in practice, is that it's got to be safe. It has to be a place where the students feel safe to realize that, hey, We're here to learn something, and it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to get the wrong answer. It's okay to raise my hand, and I won't get my head. I'm thinking of a university professor that was at a conference, and he was doing a lecture, and somebody asked a question on, like, from the previous slide, and he goes, "Well, I'm not going back. You should have gotten it then."
Ooh.
And just no more questions the rest of the week.
Cringe.
Right?
Yes.
So he created a, you know, an adversarial response. I don't know if it was deliberate or not, or what the point was of his response, or if he had history with this person or what. I have no idea, but it just shut down the room. And so whether you're doing a 20-hour lecture series class with lots of discussions and interactions and stuff, or you're doing a one-hour webinar, or you're doing a presentation for 20 minutes to a local group online, you got to start with making it okay for people to actually listen to you and to engage with you and to ask questions and so on. And I've been teaching this since I started doing webinars back in the 90s, within the first couple minutes, you got to ask people to comment or ask a question or to get started. And there's lots of techniques for that. But I find that if somebody is able to ask a question and they get a reasonable answer, right, you get way more questions. You get way more engagement. It chips away at that. Oh, okay, this guy's safe. I can ask a question.
Well, very good. Very good. So, in fact, that brings up a short story. A couple of years ago, when I went to teach a class, my contact said, "Our management would like to sit in." And in other words, I was teaching an FMEA class. Mm-hmm. And I had like 20 people. These are practitioners. And then they said they'd like to have six of the mid-level managers just sort of sit in the back. Mm-hmm. and observe. And I said no, because that's going to reduce or retard the questioning.
Yep.
From the students. And I don't want that awkward. I want them to be completely safe, like you're talking about, for mm-hmm. the students to ask questions. And I don't think they would do that as freely with their management sitting in the back watching them.
Yep.
And so that's one story on it. And another one is when I teach in person, and I'm starting to do this online, is I ask questions of the students.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to them asking me, I ask them. So if I haven't heard from Mary in a while, I'll say, "Mary, what do you think a failure mode is? Or what do you think is the application of this in your work? Or what's the definition of?" And I use Socratic method a lot in person. And I'm starting to do that online. It's not as easy when you have a large group. And so a lot of it depends on whether you have a smaller group where you can have lots of interaction,
mm-hmm.
or if you're doing a webinar with 300 people, then it's going to be different. They're going to have to put their questions more in writing, or there's going to be less opportunity for interaction.
Yep.
But those are some of my thoughts as well.
Yeah, it's always a give and take. And we talked about it when we were talking about the three samples. What are you trying to achieve in teaching? It's not to fill the hour, right? It's not to get through 87 slides or whatever.
Right.
It's to transfer knowledge. And so the environment's got to be safe. You have to have clean, clear, objectives and what you're trying to transfer across, and check steps along the way. And I also find that you got to be willing to go, "Oh, okay, you guys all get this. I don't need to go over this. Let's move on." Or mm-hmm. "No, we need to spend more time here. This is obviously a sticking point. We need to go over this a bit more closely." And to have the flexibility, I find that enables people to engage, because it's a balance. You've seen it with even FMEAs, is that you got to be flexible and follow up on leads and tangents and concepts or ideas, and then take them out to their natural conclusion without falling in the rabbit hole.
Right.
So that's absolutely a hard part. It's hard in person. It's hard online.
Rabbit hole is easy to fall into.
Yeah.
Well, you're bringing up a point that let's explore for a minute, which is the instructor or whoever's doing the presenting or teaching has to have some way to gauge the level of understanding of the audience or the students. And because, as you point out, if the students are getting it, great, move on. Explore some other things. If they're not, spend more time. Yeah. Open it up. So that means there has to be some feedback where the instructor can assess level of understanding, which could be done through quizzes. That's sort of a low-end way. Could be done through some exercises. That's a better way, where you can see what they're working on. You'd have to have decent software to be able to see if they're, you know, filling up, doing some work on their own notepad or on their computer, to where the instructor could see it and see if it makes sense what they're doing, and then provide feedback. So that level of that topic of assessing whether people are getting it or not, it's easier in person because you can see if there's a puzzled look on someone's face. It's harder remotely, but you have to pay attention to it.
Yeah. I live by the chat window when I'm doing webinars. It's just, you know, and also you got to build in time and space. One of the things I've learned early on is that when you're live in front of an audience and you ask a question, you can almost immediately see the two people that are going to answer it, right? Like, even before they put their hand up or start talking, people's body language indicates that either they've got a question or they're going to answer a question. And you can see it, right? It's not a high art in any means, but if you pay attention, you know who's going to do it. And you can select that person or not. Online, especially when you're doing a voiceover slides type scenario, you don't see them. And so you have to build in places where it's you're either going to ask a question or they are going to be prompted to ask questions. And it's the part of that check-in part. One of the things I learned, though, is after having guest speakers on the first webinar series I did, people would say, oh, are there any questions? Okay, great. Let's move on. And with like a nanosecond of time. And he says, whoa, slow down. You got to count to 10 when you prompt somebody, because they have to, one, recognize that this is the spot to ask questions because they can't see you, right? You got to create space, ask the question, pause, count to 10, because then they have to think, well, what question? I don't want to step on anybody else. Oh, where's my keyboard? How do I unmute my line? Or where do I type this in? Then they got to type it if they're typing it, right?
It's much easier for them not to ask a question, and unfortunately, and they have to exert some effort, and that's what you're saying. You have to make the space. I know when I'm in person, I will often go around the room and just spot check a few people and say, Joe, what do you think? How are things going? Do you have any questions? And he'd think for a second, go, yeah, what about so and so? Whereas if you just said, raise your hand if you have a question, he wouldn't raise his hand.
No, and you know, some people will. And but you got to create space for the entire audience, for all your students. And so a smaller group's much easier. You can go around the table, basically, and set an expectation that way or do things like that. But when you're in a larger group, you still have to create that space, one, to make it feasible, just technically feasible for them to indicate they got a question or a comment or something. And it goes back to just right from the get-go is setting those ground rules of, you know, one person talks at a time and you know, all these other things you would do in a live classroom. But you need to set up that set of structure and expectations online. And they're slightly different, but they're similar.
No, I agree. The expectations are really important. I did a webinar a while back with SAE and there were about 300 people that attended, and it was only an hour webinar. It's not a very long webinar. And I set aside 15 minutes at the end. So it's 45 minutes of, and what I decided to do was yes, if you have a question, we could do it. But I would say every 5-10 minutes, I would say, be thinking about your questions because we're setting aside time at the end. Mm-hmm. And I would remind people, please make a note or put it dot down. We have the chat window open. What your questions are. I would keep reminding them. And by the time we were done, there were 95 questions out of the 300 people. And we had time for like 7 of them.
Right.
And then I responded to all of them online afterwards with a document with the answers to them from my point of view. Mm-hmm. But I found that reminding them, which is what you're saying, set the expectations that we need questions. It's part of the learning. We don't expect you to just to absorb it, because part of learning is asking questions. That expectation is really important.
Yeah. So one last thought is, mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw Rob's Reliability Project a couple of weeks ago. He said, you know, we're all working at home. We're all, you know, we're not going to conferences. We're not doing this, that, and the thing. How about we just do a question and answer session? I'm going to open up Zoom. I'm going to have a couple of people online as a panel, and we'll, if you've got a question, send it to us early, you know, when you register, and we'll take questions while we're there. And I think he did the first one for like a half hour, and it went 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then he decided to go an hour. I don't know if he's extended it. Now he's narrowing down the topics a little bit in order to focus the discussion a bit and get the right guests on it. But it's in response to the situation. Rob stood up and said, you know, I got questions. And I get questions, but I think a lot of people do. So let's just make it public and do a Q&A thing. I thought it
That's
was
fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant.
And, I love it.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, Garl, you and I learned a lot just starting to podcast and getting comfortable behind the microphone and doing this stuff. And it was a learning experience. Mm-hmm. And it's evolved. Same with online training, same with being a participant in a meeting. It takes practice, and pay attention to what works and doesn't work, and reinforce the things that work, and you'll get better at it. There's no doubt about it.
We would love to hear from people on this. I mean, this is so important to all of us that we can learn from each other. I bet anybody listening to this podcast has some ideas as to what works and doesn't work.
Yep. And so head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form for us there. You can also find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on about our about pages. You can search for either of us. And I'm quite sure you'll find us. And we try not to be invisible. But if you've got a comment or an idea or a suggestion here for as we move more and more online, and I think a lot of us are understanding that this is probably a step function increase in the online engagement that's just not going to go away. So it's might as well get good at it.
Very good, Fred.
All right. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you again soon. Have a good time. I won't ask if you're in your pajamas. I think it's noon for you. Yeah. Just as a quick aside, remember a few years ago, there was some, I don't know what the event was. There was something going on with, I think, North Korea or something. It was some big political event occurred or whatever. And they had some correspondent in South Korea that was on a video call to a news company getting interviewed. And he was all dressed up and he had his books laid out just proper and all this stuff. And his toddler came trottling through the door and the little one in a walker, and his wife or whoever it was came in and was trying to stay out of the camera run and fetching the kids back. It was this great video.
Comedy.
It just brought a smile to your face. Here's this guy all suited up and, you know, and trying
very
to be all proper.
Very professional.
And I was in a meeting last week, and obviously somebody had kids in the background. Nobody said a thing. Nobody blinked an eye. So, you know, it's the new normal. We all have to deal with it.
Dogs barking is part of the,
it's part of the environment now. And that's what's happening. We got to deal with it. Now, if you're in a meeting situation and there's a loud gathering right outside your door, right? You would say, hey, this isn't working. You got to find a conference room or tell them to shut up or whatever. You know? But I think we're getting a lot more slack in that realm. But I think people are also getting better at just focusing on what needs to be done. And I think that's going to bring the value to this online stuff. So
great comments.
Yeah. All right. We could go another hour, I think.
But, I think so.
Yeah. So I better wrap it up. Thanks, Carl.
See you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. we invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.